You are listening to Retronauts, a part of the Greenlit Podcast Network. To hear more great shows, or to learn how you could become part of our consortium of independently owned podcasts, check out greenlitpodcasts.com. This week in Retronauts, Ave Jim Ryan, nos morituri te salutamus. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this week we are saluting Jim Ryan as we march to our deaths. Actually, not our deaths. The deaths of many, many video games. And he's given them a stay of execution. But we know that Jim Ryan is ultimately a cruel god who has no mercy for anyone. And therefore, these games have only received a temporary reprieve. That's right. We're talking, this episode is specifically sort of prompted by the recent kerfluffle online, where Sony said, "Yeah, we're shutting down basically online support for and store support for every legacy platform we've ever managed," and there was a big outcry, and people said, "But wait, there are lots of games that I still would like to purchase," and Sony for once said, "Oh, well, okay, well, we'll change that. We won't shut things down immediately." Those systems, PSP, PS3, Vita, were given a stay of execution, but the question is for how long? And so, around the same time, I got a message from some guy going under the alias Delisted Games, who was like, "Hey, this would be a good thing for us to talk about on Retronauts." And I said, "Absolutely." And at the same time, our very own Stuart Jip put together a list of PlayStation legacy games worth purchasing on these storefronts before they are shut down. So all these things kind of snowballed together, and we are hosting or recording an episode now. And this is a very kind of loosely planned episode. I don't have a lot of concrete details that I think we should cover. It's not going to be a very rigid conversation. I would like for this to be more of a free-form conversation, just going over kind of the history of, what we can know of the history of delisted games and what it means for a game to be delisted and why it's bad, and just kind of highlighting some games that would be worth picking up and playing, acquiring in some capacity before they are taken offline for good. So with me, Jeremy Parrish, here on this episode, we have, first of all, our regular, a longtime contributor, 3 years now.
Yes, hello. That was you. That sounds like me, but it might not be. No, yes, that's me. Hello, I'm Stuart Jip. I have never been delisted, but I feel like I might get blacklisted sometime.
Delisting is the video game equivalent of cancellation. Although the Sony thing was actually how cancellation works, where people are like, "Oh, they've been canceled," and then they're not actually. It's just a lot of press, and they make a lot of money off sales because people are like, "Oh, cancellation." So cancellation doesn't really exist. Delisting does.
When you appear across multiple media formats, it's explaining that you're not allowed to talk, basically.
Exactly. I have no platform, they say in the New York Times.
From multiple platforms. Yeah,
that's right.
Good stuff.
So, yes. Cancel culture is the same in video game delistings as it is in celebrity life. Anyway, enough with the politics. Who else do we have here on this episode?
Sean Sackenheim, the proprietor of one of the, in contention for one of the saddest video game sites on the internet, I think, delistedgames.com.
And it is a fantastic resource that you run, Sean. In fact, as I was putting together lists of games, I was going to sit down and really hammer out like very detailed lists of games across different platforms that have been delisted. But then, when I started to do searches for it, the main thing that came up was your site, and it's extraordinarily comprehensive. And so I just threw in some links to your site in the notes because you've done the hard work for me. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's great to hear.
So let me ask you, just tell me a little bit about the history of the games, the delisted games website, and your own kind of involvement there, and what motivated you to start doing this. Just the history there, basically.
Sure. It started back on my personal YouTube channel that is now itself delisted, thanks to Google. It was, like 2015 or 2016. I was looking through everything I had on my Xbox 360 hard drive and saw a bunch of games that I knew had been delisted and some other ones I found out later had been delisted. And I was like, you know, somebody should like look up anything about like why it's gone. Like you can, you know, Wikipedia will tell you when a game came out and who made it, stories from production, but nobody really, like it ends there. They might say this game was delisted, but then a lot of entries don't really look into why or when it disappeared. And I thought, you know, that'd be an interesting angle to take. Like here's some archival or, you know, without so much commentary over top of it, footage of games that are delisted and a little frame at the beginning where I typed up a little bit of info about it. And then I kept getting comment after comment of people saying, where can I get it? And I'd type a reply and tell them, you know, it's on PS3 or it's on Steam. And then like a week later, someone else would comment and say, where can I get it? And I was like, I'm tired of typing the same thing over and over. I'm just going to make a site.
That's a good idea.
And so that's where it kind of came from.
And the idea, the concept, the phenomenon, I guess, of delisting of games is something, you know, fairly recent, because it's only been really since the advent of digital distribution platforms that it's become an issue. Prior to, you know, online-only, digital-only sales, especially on closed platforms, you know, games were... They would you know, eventually stop being published, but they were published on physical media. So though those physical media, you know, that actual tangible, possessible thing that held the games, you could always acquire those. It might not be affordable, it might be very expensive, you know, but it would still be out there extant in some form. Whereas once you get to digital storefronts, that ceases to be the case. You know, you have these products that are only available digitally, that are only available, you know, on Sony's proprietary store or Nintendo's proprietary store or Apple's proprietary store. And, you know, they are lord and master of their own walled gardens. They, if a game ceases to be available through their platform, then that's it. Like, what do? You can't go to a used game shop and buy a delisted game that was never published physically. I mean, that's one of the reasons I started working at Limited Run Games, because they have made taking digital-only games and putting them in physical media a big part of their mission. And of course, it's not the only thing they do. And certainly, Limited Run Games, their curation efforts are not comprehensive in any way. There are so many games being published every week, just probably, if you look across all platforms, dozens, maybe hundreds sometimes, if you include like iOS and Android. Like, that's a lot of games. And Limited Run publishes like 3 games a week. So, you know, there's no way we can even, no way we can even begin to chip away that iceberg. But, you know, I think every little bit helps. And since I've been working there, they've really made a transition away from, we are only printing like 1,000 copies of this game, to, we are selling this game for 4 to 6 weeks, and anyone who places an order for it can have it. So, you know, it keeps a lot more games in circulation, and, you know, there are more copies of those games out there now, and that's good. But again, it's not even at the tip of the iceberg. It's like a tiny little chip off the front of the iceberg. You get a little sander and you can polish it up and no one would even notice. But but nevertheless, you know, it is an effort, and it's good to see that happening with various different publishers who have kind of made this their business.
I think just one thing I want to pick up, and I'm not sure if it's exactly the same, but I think that the delisted issue goes back further than you might expect. I mean, the first thing that I can think of, and I'm sure there are earlier examples, is stuff like the Sega Channel, which had games that you could only access while they were available on there. There was a Garfield. There was an expanded version of this Garfield Mega Drive game that has several extra levels that have never been recovered. They're not. You can't download the ROM. They're just not available because they were only there streaming or whatever for however many weeks, and then they were gone. And that was the only time that was available. So I'm sure there are earlier examples as well with things like bulletin boards, but I don't know them, unfortunately.
So Teleview is the thing that always comes to mind.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You can trace this back into the 70s and the Plato platform, where you just had this one networked system and everything was kind of virtual access. And, like, where are those games now? There's some formative roguelikes and other, you know, RPGs on there, but mm-hmm. those have basically vanished into the ether. So, it's always been an issue. But, of course, that wasn't, like, Plato wasn't really a commercial concern. It wasn't something that was sold. Whereas, talking about... Yeah.
No Plato Classic Mini.
No, afraid not. Okay. It would be like a tiny little diorama of a room. Because it was a quote-unquote mini computer, which means it filled an entire room. But yeah, like there were on, on the Japanese Famicom, there were services like that banking service that only... Right. existed online. So yeah, for sure, like this has been an issue for almost as long as there have been video games, but those were pretty much niche exceptions. I mean, there mm-hmm. were a few dozen games published on Satellaview on the Sega network, whereas now it's a few dozen games a week. So it's just those were kind of signs of the future, but now we are in the future and the future sucks. And I remember, early on when I was working at 1UP.com, so that'd be like 2004, 2005, I was always complaining about, like, hey, these digital service type games, MMOs and that sort of thing, like, these really suck, because if you're a fan of these and you want to go back 20 years later and play them, you don't have the opportunity. You won't be able to. Like, they're totally tied to platforms and to publishers and to their benevolence and how long can they make a profit off running this thing, and then it goes away. And obviously there have been exceptions, like homebrew servers for certain MMOs, or in the case of World of Warcraft, like you can go and buy the 2004 version of Warcraft and play that as World of Warcraft Classic or whatever it's called. But those are, again, exceptions to the rule, and the rule is basically like those things, they're just gonna go away. And I was already kind of spending a lot of time, my energy and effort, wallowing in memories of playing video games 10-15 years past, and just kind of looking forward. I was like, what if I can't do that about what I'm playing and enjoying now? That really sucks. And so I limited it, and everyone said, so who cares, like, just play the damn game. So, I think that kind of speaks to the general attitude. Like, people don't really care about this until suddenly they do. And suddenly something they want is gone. And then they're like, wait a minute. Yeah. How dare they? There's indignation. But on the whole, it's just like one of those kind of background problems that no one really thinks about. It's the, what Douglas Adams called the somebody else's problem field. It's just you don't notice it because it's somebody else's problem.
Right. It didn't help that it started out, the early, especially the early console side delistings were always like a game that was really not popular or a licensed game that was pretty bad. And so the general response from a lot of people was good, which it's, not in most cases, not good to completely delete a game from history. But that's, kind of that like knee jerk popular reaction.
Yeah, I think a lot of the first really visible delistings happened on Virtual Console for Wii, and they were games that you could still buy in cartridge format if you went to the retro shop or, you found a really musty GameStop someplace, would still have the cartridge someplace just kicking around, or eBay. Like, SimCity or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like, it's not like those games are hard to find. Like, you can find SimCity for Super NES pretty easily. They sold like a million copies of TMNT for NES. It's not going to break anyone's heart if you can't buy that, digitally, because it still exists out there.
titles like it's slightly different, but titles WiiWare stuff like the Gradius, Castlevania, and Contra Rebirth games, they've resurfaced anywhere as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't even, like, bad at all. They were really good. So there's just three excellent Konami, like, M2 throwback games that are just in the ether now, and I don't understand why they haven't packaged them together and put them out, because I'm sure they would do at least somewhat well. I would buy at least one copy.
Yes. Yeah, as a bonus on one of the other eight times that they've repackaged Castlevania games. They could just throw that on there.
When they did the Konami Anniversary Collection recently, before they announced what it was going to be, I was like, oh, there we go, it's going to be the Rebirth games. But no, they didn't remotely show up on there. I was really surprised, to be honest, because it feels like, but then again, it's Konami, so God knows what they're thinking at any time.
Right. Yeah, maybe they can't access it any longer or something. Who knows where it is.
No, that's, I don't think that's the case. Like, those are definitely around. Those are only like 10, 12 years old at this point. So, they weren't just held by Konami. They weren't developed internally. They were developed by M2. And M2 is, I think, very meticulous about curation and preservation. That's kind of what they do.
True.
So, I think it's just a matter of companies need to be convinced that there is value to bringing these old games, making them available to, you know, to keeping them in circulation. And, you know, Limited Run does have a relationship with Konami since we're publishing the Castlevania collection. And I don't think it's I don't think I'd get in trouble for saying, like, we've tried to impress on them, hey, there's a lot of really cool stuff in your back catalog that you guys need to resurface. Mm-hmm. And I don't have anything that, you know, any concrete news or information about that, like if there have been results, but certainly, like, you know, whether or not they're listening, certainly there are people who have, you know, an ear, like a direct ear, a direct line to someone at the corporation saying, this is good, this is important. So, you know, it's not for a lack of, I think, enthusiasm by the fan base. And there are lots of other publishers that kind of have made their business, you know, keeping old games in circulation, like Digital Eclipse. M2 is one of them. And so, yeah, it's just a matter of kind of making the case to the right person, and I guess the right person being in the right mood at the right time, and saying, we need to do this, yes. So, you know, it is kind of, there's a lot of gatekeeping. Like I said, the walled garden is really frustrating. But, you know, and then it has to line up with the first-party publishers, the manufacturers, you know, because who knows when they'll just decide, we're going to shut off the servers. I mean, you know, when Nintendo shut off its Wi-Fi service, that cut off access to a ton of DS games and Wii games that had, you know, content that was locked online. For example, like, if you bought a brand new copy of Dragon Quest IX at this point, which was a huge, like, you know, it sold 4 million copies or something worldwide, 5 million. But there was a ton of stuff that was time-released by connecting to Wi-Fi and by, you know, going online. And you can't access those things anymore because the Wi-Fi service is gone.
All of the bonus puzzles in Professor Layton in the entire series as well, they're not accessible anymore without hacks, I don't think.
Yeah.
Right. And so it does a lot of this, you know, things like that where there's stuff on the cartridge that just has to be unlocked online. Like, people complained about, hey, why do I have to pay $5 for this sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that is crappy. Like, it's, you know, literally just a string of code. You're paying $5 for a string of code that says, okay, unlock this. But the plus side of that kind of mercenary business practice is that code, that data exists on the actual, you know, CD or cartridge, so you can at least access it somehow if you hack it right. Whereas stuff that was pushed from a server, like an actual sizable 1 gigabyte download, like, what are you going to do, you know, 10 years from now when you want to play, I don't know, GTA Online? I'm assuming that at that point, they will finally no longer, like, people will no longer be playing GTA Online. I don't know. Maybe GTA 5 will still be, like, the best-selling game in the world and still, like, coming out for every platform. But
it might be the only game left.
Could be. But you know, like, what are you going to do with all that data that is... It only exists on Rockstar servers and not on, you know, not on the discs themselves. So it's a tricky issue. And it's, you know, like I said, the industry doesn't have a huge interest in preserving and maintaining that stuff because they're just not going to make a lot of money off of it.
Looking at the lists on delistedgames.com and sort of recent higher profile delistings, like, I know it's back now, but like Scott Pilgrim and stuff like that. I mean, licensed games seem to have a pretty low run in general. There was stuff like Marvel Ultimate Alliance that sort of came and went and then went and then came and went again.
Yeah.
So licensing, on top of everything else that we've talked about, licensing seems to be a massive problem with these games.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost always a licensing thing first. If it's not a developer or publisher, shutting down or stopping working on a certain platform and just like pulling all their stuff down, it's almost always a license of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the element of just a publisher saying, well, you know, is it worth going through all these hoops, you know, getting something re-registered and, you know, maybe there are licenses to re-up or getting a new ESRB rating. Like, you have to go through a lot of hoops to get something back into circulation. Mm. And I will say that there have been some products that we've been involved with at Limited Run where it was really an uphill battle to convince the publisher, like, hey, this is good, but we knew there was a demand for something, you know, for those games. And so we also realized that once we kind of, if we are able to get it out there and publish it and able to say, look, people want this, they were excited, they bought it, it's going to open the floodgates. And these companies are going to be more receptive in the future to saying, oh, we made a big fat stack of loot off this last thing we did, so let's make more big fat stacks of loot. So, you know, I think it's just getting over that initial kind of hump, you know, that proving the case that it is worth doing this, that there is value in it. That's kind of the challenge. And that's one of the things that I know a lot of companies, publishers, or like small boutique publishers like Limited Run are definitely working on, you know, behind the scenes, just getting past that first initial push. And, you know, I think with a lot of things, there is this excited fan base out there, like an audience that's eager to play these things, these great games from 5, 10, 20 years ago. And it's just a matter of getting the numbers and saying it's actually worth it. So I'm really hoping that, you know, the work that we're doing and Digital Eclipse and so forth really helps big publishers to realize, you know, like, This is good. There's money in this stuff that is literally just sitting around, not doing anything for us. We can put this to work for us and we can make money off of it. What a crazy idea.
Yeah, and then capitalize on the success of that and maybe make something new, God forbid.
Well, let's not get crazy, but but yes, I mean, that's always a possibility too. But just the idea of making certain that games stay in circulation, and just because the hardware is obsolete doesn't mean the game itself is no longer good or fun. That doesn't mean people don't want to enjoy and play that game. Like, you look at something like, you know, I mentioned Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles earlier, like the arcade games, people still love to play those. People still love stuff like, you know, any of those multiplayer 4-6 player just messy stupid brawlers. Like, Those are eternally popular. Like, when you go to conventions, you know, RIP conventions, those arcade machines always had, you know, in the kind of retro arcade areas, they always had crowds around them. People just wanting to play X-Men or Simpsons or something because they're good, dumb fun.
And both of those did actually come out on the 360 by Backbone, I think. But then they were then themselves delisted. So yeah. I'm hoping they'll come back at some point. But
right. I was surprised to see. I was hopeful that would happen after the that arcade 1-Up version of Ninja Turtles a couple years ago. But it didn't extend out into a new digital release for that one.
I wonder if the current Shredder's Revenge, the new one that's very, very similar to Turtles in Time, might prompt re-releases of some sort, but you never know, unfortunately.
I mean, that's the kind of thing, like, that's the kind of game where you can just see them including the original as an unlockable, but I guess these days they don't do that. It's like, why give someone something for free when you can upsell?
Yeah, it was just last year, 2020, I gave away a copy of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Battle Nexus 2 that had an unlockable version of the 1989 arcade game in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the last times I can think of a whole old game being just in there as an unlockable.
It would be remiss of me to point this out, and I apologize because it is a slight tangent, but that version of the game, man, it's got all, they changed all the music.
Yes,
they changed it to music from the 2003 cartoon. They should never have. I mean, you know, they tried. Good, bless them for trying, I suppose.
Right, yeah, it's playable, but not the real spirit, not the version you want. It's the version we've got.
All right, so I think we've made the case for delisting bad, access to classic games good. So I do want to kind of just go through, you know, some of the platforms that have really suffered from this and talk about why and maybe some notable games that are worth pointing out, worth playing, or, you know, grabbing before it's too late or finding some way, or, you know, just be sad that you'll never get to play them, whatever. To begin with, there's iOS, and I noticed that your site, Sean, has an iOS page, but it's just like a paragraph that says, yeah, there's a lot of stuff on there.
yeah, don't listen to them.
It's only me working on the site. And so iOS and Android, like Flash, you know, like to keep track of every Flash game that ever happened is just, that's amazing feat. It would take like teams of people to keep up with, like the archive project that's going on with Flash stuff. But yeah, iOS, I kind of cut it off at consoles. I've always been more of a console person anyway, so that's where I had the most stuff, and that's where I started and kind of spread out into Steam and good old games and Epic now.
Well, all I know is on my old iPod Touch, when they updated it to 64-bit architecture or whatever it was, I lost access to my copy of the Macintosh game Glider,
mm-hmm.
and that basically changed me forever. I was very, very depressed as a result, because I love Glider. I love it so much, you don't even know. I don't know what other games there were. I only care about Glider in this case, but yeah, it was a sad time.
Yeah, I would say of all the platforms in the world, iOS is probably the single platform to suffer from the greatest number of delisted games. And Stuart, you mentioned the 64-bit transition, and that really was a huge kind of cutting off point. That was 2018 when they kind of put their foot down and said, okay, we've been using 64-bit architecture for a while, and if you want an app to run from this point on, it has to be updated from a 32-bit program to 64-bit. And most programs designed for the 32-bit environment, just most publishers, most developers didn't care or didn't have the resources or couldn't be arsed.
Yeah.
And, you know,
weren't operating anymore.
Right. And, you know, I do think iOS is an interesting case because it does kind of raise the question of whether or not every video game is necessarily worth preserving. Like, we always talk about the classics. We talk about, you know, Castlevania, you know, crap, what was it called that M2 made? Rebirth.
Rebirth. Castlevania the Adventure Rebirth.
Yes. So big popular brands or franchises, big popular platforms, you know, things people love. That's what we always talk about. Scott Pilgrim. But, like, if you look at most of what comes out on iOS, it is just, literally, some of it is just the lowest possible effort garbage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are so many games that are just there. You look at a bunch of games and they're all exactly the same with like some superficial changes and a new name. So it can be resold. Yeah. And a lot of these are just, you know, link farms, ad farms, almost zero value in terms of gameplay or entertainment. And it, you know, do those things necessarily need to be preserved from the objective perspective? Sure, it would be good to have them, you know, archived someplace just to say, hey, these existed. But I mean, does anybody really care about, like, Baby Doll Surgery 2013 if you can't play that anymore?
I want my children's children to play Frozen Elsa pregnant.
Exactly. So, yeah, it does kind of, you know, iOS, just the sheer number of games that are no longer available and the sheer ratio of crap to good really does kind of strain, I think, the limits of this whole conversation.
I mean, all the same, when it happened to me, because I put off the update for as long as I possibly could, it would prompt me like twice a day, every day, like, update this now. And I'd be like, no. And then eventually I did. I just gave up. And, you know, I lost access to probably like a fifth of the stuff that I bought and paid for. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the only way I could get that back now would be to get an old device that hadn't been updated and then ignore the updates again. I mean, when it happened, I think even really huge stuff like the original Infinity Blade didn't work anymore. And that was a massive game. That was like one of the first big iOS games. Mm-hmm. I think it's been updated since then. But in a way, it's probably one of the more outrageous sort of D-list things that has been, simply because it was just a case of not only are we... not only we're not allowing this, but you won't be able to play your old games that you may have paid real money for. And there's no way around it besides, well, probably hacking, I suppose, but there's no legitimate way around it, you know.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, Infinity Blade is a great example because it was held up by Apple. I remember going to, you know, like press events, some of the last press events where Steve Jobs was alive, and, you know, them having that game out there and being like, look at what you can do on an iPad. It's a real honest to God video game. It's legit. It wasn't packed with microtransactions. It was a pay once up front and buy it. This was before, you know, Candy Crush Saga, and everyone realized, like, hey, if you give people a game for free and then, you know, make sure that the design at some point is really broken, so they have to pay microtransactions to make progress once they're hooked. Yeah. That's a much more profitable approach. This was, you know, kind of the old model, the classic, you know, package retail model. And as such, it was, you know, a very classic style game. And it was a great proof of concept for the iOS platform, because it was a demonstration that, hey, you could have a console style, you know, arcade style action game that looked great and played pretty well, and pay whatever it was, $14.99 up front. And there you go. You've got it. And, you know, the platform definitely made transitions from there. And the studio behind Infinity Blade Chair, you know, their boss, Donald Mustard, basically is the guy who runs Fortnite now. So he has much bigger fish to fry. Like, when you are working with literally multi-billion dollar property, like a dinky little iOS game, you know, as cool as it was 10 years ago, like how much do you really care about that, you know, about keeping it up and running? So yeah, it's just, you know, it wasn't a priority for them. And yeah. I didn't realize that it had been updated so it does run on 64-bit, which is good. But it really was, you know, a demonstration of, like, how the evolution of iOS and just the overall transition of kind of the free-to-play, you know, freemium-type model, not just on iOS but also in terms of Fortnite success, really put the kibosh on this idea of preservation and you know, the old way of doing things, basically.
Mm. Mm-hmm. There was I remember one of the things I lost access to has just reoccurred to me, is the really beautifully done cave ports. I don't know how to pronounce this. Mushihime-sama Bug Princess.
Mm-hmm.
They're beautifully done touch-enabled versions of these really renowned kind of hardcore shoot 'em ups that were just no longer playable. I think they probably have patched them, but there was just a long time where it was just like, well, that's it. That's gone. That was like $6.99 game. That's gone. Don't unpatch it. That's gone. That sort of thing. And it was crazy how it was just like a guillotine came down and that was it. It was wild.
Yeah. It was a very, Obi-Wan millions of voices crying out and suddenly being silenced.
Yeah, exactly.
Might literally have been millions.
Yeah, it's got to be.
probably not millions, but thousands for sure.
Well, total, sorry.
Yeah, I would...
Just thinking about the history of iOS, yeah, it's got to be at least 1 million apps and games, things you could buy on that store.
Each more brilliant than the last.
Yeah.
See, it's interesting mentioning Cave because we'll get to it probably later, but one of the things I did when they announced that they were closing the PlayStation stores is I jumped on the Japanese store and bought all the Cave shooters that were on there.
Nice.
It's not that many. It's just Danpachi and Dodonpachi, and there's probably some more. But, I mean, once they're gone from there, where else am I going to buy them legally? I have no idea.
All right, so it's really hard to say much more about iOS because it's all just so massive and vague. But, you know, like I said, the platform has really evolved over time from the kind of, hey, classic video games model to the, hey, it's free. The first hit's free. Oh, you better pay. Better give us, you know, $10 for your booster, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, my account is linked to my wife's Apple account, and there was a while where she was playing a lot of Candy Crush, and you know, I would get these receipts like, "Hey, someone just spent $5 on a Candy Crush pack," and you know, I'm like, "That's fine if she enjoys it, whatever. How much do I spend on video games? I can't complain." But I just noticed like she spent a lot more on that one game than I have on, you know, any standard retail release for sure. So, you know, that I think really kind of became the metric for iOS. Like if you can keep just raking in cash from microtransactions and that sort of thing, that's kind of the way the way people measure success on iOS. And, you know, if they make a game and people don't pay the transactions, microtransactions, then that gets delisted too.
Yeah, definitely. If there's no profit left, you pull it down and move people on to the next one.
That seems to happen with a fair amount of anime tie-in, like gacha games recently. Mm-hmm. I think there was one that's only been up for 6 months that's going down pretty soon.
Oh, wasn't that the one that that Keiji Inafune had worked on?
Oh, that makes sense.
There was some, I want to say Keiji Inafune. It was someone who was a big deal for a while and then has been kind of like, oh.
And then made Mighty No. 9.
Yeah. Things didn't go so well. And their attempt at a gacha game. I think it was him. It might have been someone else. But anyway, yes, iOS, it went away. Or I don't know. I think Apple probably looks at these kind of purges as a benefit to themselves. It's like an opportunity to prune and to weed out the crap from the platform because there is so much crap. So, you know, if they have these kind of hard transitions where people who are no longer invested in maintaining their game, just let it die and go away, then that means, you know, it just basically like clears out the clutter for Apple. So they honestly probably look to delistings, these mass purges, as, you know, beneficial. So
the thing is, when you're me, then some of those crap games are actually amazing. And we lost a Dizzy. We lost a Dizzy permanently because of this. We lost Prince of the Oak Folk.
And
I mean, to be fair, it was a god-awful, terrible remake of it, but it's still gone forever. That's another Dizzy I'll never get back.
You should petition the Oliver twins about that. You're friends with them, right? Like, everyone in the UK knows each other.
Yeah, my only interaction with the Oliver twins was to visibly upset one of them once. And I do feel quite bad about that. But I'll save that story for the Oliver Twins episode.
When we get them on the show.
Yeah.
Surprise, we've brought stewardship.
The eyes narrow and they use their twin powers to destroy me.
All right, so moving on from iOS, let's actually save the PlayStation stuff for the end since Stuart put together such a great list of stuff.
Well, thanks, Jeremy.
You did. You got paid for it, too, so I expected Hooray! No less.
This worked out so well for everyone.
But, yes, the Nintendo DS and DSi, I think, are kind of where they're... Did DSi wear launch before WiiWare? I feel like it did, but maybe I'm lying.
Yeah.
I don't think it did. I thought it was specifically like a play from WiiWare. I don't think it did.
Okay, you're right and I'm wrong. How sad. Yeah, so honestly, there wasn't really much released digitally only for DS and DSi. Nothing for DS, but DSi, like the whole selling point was like, hey, you can buy games digitally, but they're not the games you want. There was no virtual console. There were no retail games released through DSiWare. It was all like little mini games, and there were some cool mini games. Some pretty good stuff.
There was a solid port of Earthworm Jim on there,
which
is gone now.
Yeah, there was some virtual. It would have been in a virtual console if there was one on there, but yeah, no official like retro section.
Right. Yeah, I mean, looking over the list, you have stuff like Cut the Rope, Earthworm Jim, Go Series.
That's it.
Pickdun was kind of neat. I bought the Pickdun games. Those were kind of like first-person shooters that were also, or not first, first-person maze crawlers, dungeon crawlers. They were kind of like RPG, and I want to say also like kind of puzzle game-ish. It was like Picross meets a dungeon crawler. It's been a while since I've played them.
Yeah.
What?
They had like a really great little animated sprite. That's what I liked about them.
Oh, what? There's a Mr. Driller game on here. There's a Mr. Driller game on here, and I missed
there was,
it.
And that was kind of when I interviewed Hideo Yoshizawa, the creator of Mr. Driller, back in like, God, 2012, 2013. It was a long time ago. I asked, like, is there a future for Mr. Driller? And he was like, no, no one buys these. And the DSiWare game, Drill Till You Drop, is pretty much like our final statement. Like, we feel like that has everything Damn. That people love. So that was it. That was the culmination of Mr. Driller.
Yeah.
Though we did get Drill Land on the Switch, at least. That was
we did. It. We did, but you know, he kind of looked at Drill Till You Drop as sort of like the final statement, and now it's gone. There's no, like, if you did not buy Drill Till You Drop, your journey through the world of Mr. Driller is incomplete. You can never hear the final statement.
The one that's really leaping out at me from this list is The Legend of Zelda Four Swords Anniversary, because that was free, wasn't it? They give that away for free.
Yeah, it was. There was they've given it away, I think, a couple times.
Yeah. But then, if
and
you
then
didn't
taken it away,
if you didn't get it, that's a fairly, I mean, that's a pretty good game, isn't it? That's the Game Boy Advance. It was packed in with Link to the Past, wasn't it?
Yeah,
or was that actually a different game?
I believe the one that they put on DSiWare was basically a conversion of the GBA bonus mode. Yeah,
right. So, but if you didn't get that, then that's gone. You can't get that now. That's not, unless, as far as we know, that's not coming back, and that's. That's a temple. That's one of the big two. That's The Legend of Zelda.
It's right up there with F-Zero.
Mm, yeah, which is never coming back in any form, ever.
Yeah, they said so. We've already got... What is their current racing game? Oh, right, Mario Kart. I've heard of that one. Yes.
Yeah. Donkey Kong Barrel Blast.
I mean, you can play as Captain Falcon in Mario Kart, right? Can't you? No?
Can you?
You should be able to.
I don't actually know.
Well, but you should be able to. If you
I mean,
can't.
At this point,
you can play as Isabelle.
Yeah, right. The roster update for Mario Kart 8 was.
But like, who do we have in our big pile of characters? Who do we have that would fit well into a racing game? The dog from Animal Crossing.
Right, in a BMW or a Mercedes or whatever it was they added.
She's very much about the luxury brands. She's got her Gucci sweater and everything. So anyway, yeah. So the DSiWare platform is actually, there's not a whole lot that was culled. Let's see, your list is 38 games. And most of these are things like no one really cares. There's a few good games on there, but as someone who was covering DSi in the press at the time of its existence, most of these games were things I would download and be like, oh, this will be cool. Like, I can't wait to try this out. This seems interesting and fun. And then I would play it and say, oh, this is a kind of mediocre port of a bad mobile game. All right, never mind.
And the majority of them did come over to the 3DS, except for they called out specifically 10 titles that couldn't be transferred.
And why was that? Was it just like were they just being pissy?
I have the list of them. I think it's all... Well, one of them, I think, is the browser. The DSi internet browser. Of course, is not going to come to the 3DS.
That's a great loss.
Asphalt 4. So, Flipnote Studio, that version. But then they ended up redoing it on the 3DS. So I think they just left, you know, that version behind on the DSi. Let's Golf, or a version of Oregon Trail, a couple real soccer games, and a couple Sudoku games.
Damn.
And I'm not sure who's behind, you know, the Sudoku ones and the soccer. Like, if it was real soccer, it might have been a license issue with the leagues.
Right.
Something like that.
So basically, like, these are concepts that are pretty generalized, not necessarily things that were like, wow, this was something really unique to DSi.
Right. Yeah, except the DSi browser. You'll never be able to browse the internet like that again.
I theorize that the reason they couldn't bring that over is because it had some kind of security hole that would let them hack the 3DS.
That too.
Yeah. Thankfully, the 3DS is completely unhackable. It has never been done and no one has managed to do it.
Praise God. So moving on to the 3DS, since we talked about that, the list of delisted games here is much more extensive. I'm really surprised there are so many games that you cannot play anymore. And a lot of these are things that I've heard of. A lot of these are games that did get retail counterparts, you know, in various forms, like Advance Wars, Days of Ruin. I didn't even realize that was available on 3DS, actually. Was that like a...
Yeah, I had no idea that was
virtual
digitally.
Console kind of thing? What was that?
Let's see. It's a good thing I wrote something about it. It looks like it is only on the 3DS in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, was it Club Nintendo?
Yes.
Yeah, because they had on the... I think this was probably the US as well, but one of the rewards from the old My Nintendo, or whatever it was called back then, was WarioWare Touched on the 3DS for some reason.
Oh.
Maybe that was the sort of Japanese equivalent game. Because that was what the only DS game I can think of that was released as a 3DS app in this country was WarioWare Touched, bizarrely.
Interesting. Yeah, but looking at a lot of these, you have stuff like Disney's Epic Mickey, you have a bunch of Adventure Time games, you have, what else is there? Game Boy games like Tetris for Virtual Console. So, Lego the Hobbit. You know, these are games all... Actually, that's been relisted. Mario and Sonic. So these are games that were, you know, available physically. So this was just the eShop versions that were delisted. But then you have a lot of things that I know were not released physically as well. So when a game is you know, available at retail, I don't think it's as huge a loss. Like, you can still go out and buy that cartridge someplace.
Right. Yeah.
It's still able to get it for sure. Yeah. I mean, the 3DS version of VVVVVV is gone for good now.
I believe the proper pronunciation of that title is the letter V six times.
Ah, okay. Well, I've decided to change it.
I like to say VVVVVV.
But I mean, that's a sad loss because that version with the 3D looked really good. Really popped out nicely, and that's gone now for good, so that sucks.
It did get relisted at one point.
Oh, okay, well, never mind then.
That was 2016 that I had it, and I don't know that I have searched for it on a 3DS in a while. So I'm not sure if it got pulled again. Yeah, okay, sorry, February 2018. It left again. Sorry, it did come back, and then it left again.
It was probably my favorite version because of that 3D feature, and I think there was even some extra sort of levels in the player levels category in that, because some of the later releases of that game have stages made by indie developers using the editor. And I think that one included some of them, which was really pretty cool. But I'm not sure if those made it to, say, the Switch version or the PSP or, sorry, the Vita version. Maybe they did, I don't know. But they weren't in 3D, damn it.
So the most interesting thing on here to me that I was not aware of is Dragon Quest. Like, the original Dragon Quest 1 was available for about 6 months in Asia. And it was available to people who played Dragon Quest 11, beat the game, and entered a spell that appeared in the credits. That's wild.
Whoa.
So
that's
if
cool.
if you beat the game within that first 6 months, you could get a free copy of Dragon Quest. But that was only in Japan, not here in the US.
Right.
Or in Europe.
There are a couple of obscure ones on here that I liked, but they are physically available, so it might not be worth highlighting. But that second Pac-Man game, Pac-Man the Ghostly Adventures 2, is pretty ambitious because they basically crammed the entire Xbox 360 game version onto a 3DS, so it runs at about 10 frames per second. But it's still pretty fun, and it's basically a full-size console 3D platformer on a handheld. I also want to highlight, because no one is ever going to talk about this game anywhere else ever, and it's my duty to do so, that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game based on the Michael Bay produced movie is a genuinely legit Diablo clone.
Huh.
And I mean, I don't know how that happened.
It's Activision Blizzard, so I guess that makes sense.
but it's genuinely good. But again, you can buy those in physical copies as well. Same with Danger of the Ouse, which is a really good Metroidvania. It's sort of inspired by Radical Rescue, the third original Game Boy Turtles game.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like that because you basically go around 2D levels with your Metroid map, rescuing the other turtles and gaining their abilities. I should mention that because it's good.
Another thing that kind of stands out to me is Etrian Mystery Dungeon. That's the only one of the Etrian Odyssey games that's been discontinued digitally. I mean, they're all available physically, but that one has kind of shot up in price in terms of the physical release. So there's no alternative. You can't like go online and buy the digital. So yeah, so 3DS, there's definitely some notable stuff and definitely some stuff that was exclusive to the digital storefront that's been culled, which is a shame. So moving over to the physical side, Wii and Wii U, looking at the Wii list, it is a lot of Virtual Console stuff. I mean, at this point, like anything that was on Wii Virtual Console and WiiWare is gone, right? Like
right.
Just totally
yeah.
gone.
That's why a lot of these were added before that store was shut down. And then there's a page in here somewhere, I think under N, that's just for the Nintendo Wii Shop channel. So at some point I had made marketplace pages for the Wii Shop channel and the DSi channel, PlayStation Mobile, Xbox Live indie games, like these whole separate marketplaces or places to buy a bunch of games that on the site at least could not list out every single title that had ever touched it. So it eventually ended up with sort of a Wii Shop channel page for WiiWare and Virtual Console.
But I think the page that exists now with the individual callouts for 75 Wii games is really valuable because it shows like, you know, before the entire platform died off or was killed, what was actually being delisted, like which publishers were pulling their support and pulling their licenses, which apparently is like SNK, Hudson, and iRim. Those seem to be the big ones.
Yes.
Right.
Man, I didn't know that the Virtual Console had all the R-Type games worth playing on it. That's insane.
Mm-hmm. The Wii Virtual Console was jam-packed.
I never had one until way after it was already basically dead, and I wish I'd gone on there and bought all the games now.
Well, you know, one of my biggest regrets, I'm sure I've mentioned this on the show before, is that, you know, I was covering Wii Virtual Console stuff for 1UP throughout its lifetime. And so I was constantly buying games. You know, there were some that I didn't own, but I spent, I would say, probably close to $1,000 on Virtual Console. And then when Wii U came out, I was like, oh, well, I need to take these over to Wii U for sure. And now I deeply regret that because the Wii U emulation on a lot of the platforms, especially NES, was really crappy. And the Wii would have been a great place to actually be able to output these games to 240p. Like this was before I understood, you know, any of this resolution stuff and, you know, all the work that I do now with trying to upscale and get good RGB quality. Like the Wii had that and I had all of those games on there and I could have, you know, gotten them in amazing video quality.
Yeah.
But no, I moved them over to Wii U, a platform whose Virtual Console was so bad that, Kamiya, what's his face? Hideki Kamiya of Platinum Games bitches about it. He's like, Nintendo, why is your Virtual Console so bad? Why does it suck so much? And it does. It sucks. It's bad.
It wasn't too bad because they did release Donkey Kong 64 on it.
Well,
the
N64, I think, had better emulation, but the NES and Super NES was really bad. And also,
yeah, it was dark and slow. And wasn't it based on maybe the PAL version of some of the games? Am I imagining that?
I don't know, but it looked bad.
I think so. I think it was, yeah.
I think it definitely was for the Donkey Kong Country stuff. Not that you can make Donkey Kong Country 3 any slower.
And on from Wii to Wii U it was a move, right? You mm-hmm. can keep them on the Wii nope. also.
It was like, we know you're going to give this away to someone or sell it.
Yeah.
So you can't keep these things. Yeah. But if you look
over the way.
If you look over at Wii U, like the delisted games are a lot of them are the same delisted games as on Wii, like the same virtual console games. But then you also have, you know, really important stuff like Super Mario Maker, which is not, I guess, delisted in the sense that you can't buy it so much as they just don't support the trading and all the features that made that game so amazing.
Right. Like the real reason you would get Super Mario Maker is excised out of there.
Yep. Mm. And so then it just becomes, you know, like the 3DS version, except without all the, you know, the stages that were pre-made. So why own it? It really diminishes one of Nintendo's most interesting and creative projects of the past decade. Like Super Mario Maker was so good and so revelatory when it first came out. And now, less than a decade later, it's just gone.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, yeah. There's Super Mario Maker 2 on Switch, but it's not the same. Like having that was the game that Wii U was created for. They didn't know it when they were creating the game or when they were creating the system, but that was it. That was the one that everyone wanted, you know.
The original Mario Maker has the event stages and the different skins for Mario, and I think they're gone completely from 2. And there were so many of them. I felt like there were hundreds, and they were all a lot of fun as well. And also, frankly, drawing levels on the gamepad was a lot easier than doing it on the Switch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I've always heard, is that, you know, it's better in every way on the Switch except for, like, actual usability and that content.
Well, I got my Wii U very late, and I spent quite a lot of time on Mario Maker in its sort of twilight kind of days, and then I was quite excited for Mario Maker 2, and when that came out, because of the transition from, you know, stylus-based touchscreen to finger-based touchscreen, though you can obviously buy a stylus, it's still not as good. it's just inherently worse, unfortunately, and the lack of the event stages didn't give me much of a reason to sort of go back to it. So I was pretty disappointed with Mario Maker 2 in the end. I didn't have much of an incentive to get into it.
And one of the, on the Wii U especially is, and this kind of maybe not completely founded information, but I've heard from a few smaller indie developer publishers that at some point, I think it was 2018 to 2019, Nintendo stopped allowing them to renew their license to be a publisher for Wii U. So they didn't have a choice whether their game was delisted or not. Even if they wanted to keep it on there, they just weren't allowed to function as the publisher. And I don't know if that's 100% accurate, but I've heard from that same kind of thing from a couple different people.
I mean, it would make sense. They really, that is a section of their history that they really seem eager to just, you know, leave behind them and set fire to. So I can understand where they wouldn't want, you know, people keeping the platform alive any longer than absolutely necessary.
Yeah. And some of them are, you know, some of the people who have lost their game on the Wii U are still publishing stuff on the Switch. So you'd think it might cross over, but there's something in their way there.
So yeah, I feel like of all the Wii U stuff that was delisted, Super Mario Maker is definitely the most notable and interesting, just because it's not, you know, it's not just the game itself, but the entire, like, functionality of the retail version. Like, that game, no matter how you buy it, is just no longer the full game. It's just a shadow of itself.
Yeah.
All right, so that's Nintendo stuff. We don't have to go on any longer about them. I did want to talk very briefly about Xbox 360. I was really surprised by how many delisted games there are on 360. Because, you know, you think of Microsoft as being the one first party that really seems to care about backward compatibility and about maintaining its library. Like, you know, Xbox One X or Series X is like a big part of that is that you can basically play any Xbox game on it. You can stick a disc from the original Xbox in there and you can play it.
Yeah.
And they've really put a lot of work into making that possible and to maintaining that continuity. And it's not a trivial amount of work because the architecture of each platform has been so different from the last. Like the original Xbox was an Intel chip and then they switched over to I want to say PowerPC based chip for 360. And then I can't even remember what at this point it's basically like a, you know, a beefy PC, but making backward compatibility seamless and functional with all those architectural changes and wildly different platforms throughout its history, that takes effort and manpower and energy and resources and money. So, you know, I really
got hundreds and hundreds of them working. It's great.
Yeah. I respect Microsoft for making that effort because they don't have to do that. They mm-mm. don't have to, you know, say we're going all in on this. They could just say, hey, you know, our best games, you can play them and you can play like last gen games and that's it. But no,
even now, like they're still updating it. They recently, they've made a bunch of old, backwards compatibility games now run at twice the frame rate, for example. They are going back and making these fixes, which I do appreciate.
So like Earth Defense Force now operates at like 15 frames a second.
Well, actually Earth Defense Force, even on the bit of a tangent, sorry, but even on the PS5, that now runs at, I think, locked 60 all the time.
That must be so weird. I need to try that.
It's
sometime.
Weird. I hate it. It's not right. It's
Where's
too
the
hard.
Jank?
It's still plenty janky. Yeah, I love that whole series. I've actually, since the PlayStation stuff came up, I've been playing through Earth Defense Force 2 on PlayStation TV the last couple weeks.
Yeah.
But yeah, on the 360 side, I wanted to add, even before the Xbox One, there are cases where a game will be delisted or would have been delisted, and the publisher has switched from whoever had published it originally to Microsoft Games. So I think they were doing work to take over some of these games, even despite how many are on the site already. I think there would be a lot more if it weren't for someone or some team there, you know, doing that work to keep games online.
And in some of these cases, it seems like, you know, the games are delisted on one platform, but it's not like they're gone forever. Right. Like the Doom trilogy for Xbox 360, you know, those were digital only releases. They were a pretty big deal at the time because, wow, finally it's the Doom games, you know, designed to be played with a gamepad. Like you're not just kind of kludging it in. It's actually how these versions were meant to be played. And, you know, for those of us who had gotten used to FPSs on a gamepad, it was great to have those games available on the platform that way. And those were really well-regarded versions. And they delisted...
Yeah, not compromised.
Yeah, they delisted these games in July of 2019, but then, like, those same games were basically immediately brought out on Xbox One. So, among other platforms. So, you know, there is some continuity there. It's just like, hey, we're not supporting this old version because if you buy, you know, the new platform that has the backward compatibility, you can get the same game just, you know, running in current gen, like a current gen shell.
Though, if you do own those old versions, you can still download them on the Series X, but I don't know why you would want to. Right. I think they might have updated them, actually. I think they might have updated them wholesale to be the new versions, because there is really no reason why you would want to go back with a game like Doom. I mean, Doom 2, when it was originally released on the 360 and PS3, they added a new episode called No Rest for the Wicked. And that was then added to the new port eventually. So they have kept a decent amount of continuity there.
Well, I know they updated Shadow Complex to run on Xbox One, and then like a few months later, Shadow Complex Remastered was released. And the question was kind of like, why would I buy Shadow Complex Remastered if I can just, you know, play the original game, which looks almost the same. It's not quite the same, but it's pretty similar. So yeah, like there's definitely some I guess, a little clumsiness with how these are handled sometimes. But yeah, I'm curious, like, there's hundreds and hundreds of Xbox 360 games that cannot be purchased anymore, but you can, if you own these digitally, the license, you can still download them to play on modern, like the current gen platform, right?
Right, in most cases, yeah.
If they're compatible, yeah, because it's not a one thing, unfortunately. There are a lot of 360 games that aren't compatible with the one. One of the major ones for me is Bangaio, whatever the version of Bangaio was on the 360. I forget what it's called, but I can't play that on the Xbox One or the Series X, unfortunately. That's why I still have my 360 hooked up.
Yeah, and then stuff like Game Room, you know, being a service, you know, within a service being, discontinued, that you... Can you still... I was able to re-download them at one point. I'm not sure if you still can re-download Game Room.
I would be surprised if you couldn't, because you'd think there would be a big kickoff about that.
Yeah.
For the 7 or 8 people who bought anything through it.
I mean, yeah, would there be a big to-do? Because the whole thing with Game Room is, for some reason, no one really cared. It just kind of... Like, they hyped it up. I remember going to press events for it.
Yeah.
Thinking, oh, this is cool. And then it just kind of just vanished.
Well, I think everyone lost faith in them because the last game pack was sort of data mined and it had Sunset Riders in it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then Sunset Riders did not come out on Game Room, and we had to wait for it to come out on Arcade Archives many, many, many years later. And I think people were disillusioned with it.
Hey, Lassie, what are you doing here? Timmy's in a well. Sequelcast 2 and Friends is a podcast looking at movies in a franchise, one film at a time, like Harry Potter, Hellraiser, and The Hobbit. And sometimes the hosts talk about video games and TV as well. And now it's part of the Greenlit Podcast Network. Oh, Lassie, we don't need to rescue Timmy. He likes the well enough, I guess. Darth Vader is Luke's father. Lassie, I told you to lay off the spoilers.
And we're back, folks, with another episode of Nasty Labs.
Nasty Labs.
It's a show hosted by me, Kinsey Burke, and my dumbass friend Mark.
Nasty Labs.
This twice-monthly show about game development, Japan life, being nice to people, and hey, maybe a few other things.
Nasty Labs
is a product of Chuhai Labs Brand Incorporated, and now available for 3 easy payments of $420.69, only on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
All right, so that's really about all there is to say with Microsoft, unless you want to talk about like Steam games and stuff. But that's not Microsoft; that's Valve, and the PC platform is kind of in the same sphere as iOS. Like, it's just so big and so kind of difficult to manage. So, better to look over at PlayStation and the Jim Ryan Hall of Execution. these platforms are going to die at some point. We don't know when Jim's broadsword is going to come down on their neck, but at some point we're going to see, you know, the PSP's head rolling down the aisle looking stunned, just shocked.
I mean, yeah, the PSP is still going in July. That's the only one they're not saving, I believe,
right?
Which means that the PSP version of Prince of Persia Forgotten Sands is going to be physical only, and it's a great game, so yeah, it shouldn't be.
Yeah, so looking over your lists here, Stuart put together a series of articles for Retronauts.com called PSN 100, looking at 100 games that are bound to be delisted from Sony legacy platforms at some point. Some soon, some not so soon, but they'll die eventually.
Worth noting, this list does skew very heavily towards the old sort of JIP quotient of things that I like.
I mean, you took input, so it's got Brandish in there.
I took a tiny bit of it. I took a tiny bit of input, and then I deleted it all to put more Atari games on there. So.
But again, a lot of the games that you listed here are available physically. In fact, I think most of them are. So
the majority of them are, yeah.
Yeah. There is a game you put on here that is only available in Europe, and I resent that. Breath of Fire 3. They did not bring that one to the U.S. because
that surprised me, because when I went,
Sony of America was like, the PSP is a glorious device full of beauty and splendor, and it must not be a porting house for PlayStation 1 games. That is for the weak and stupid. And meanwhile, Japan and Europe are like, we're okay with being weak and stupid. We'll make some money. That's cool.
We love being weak and stupid. But it's
profitable.
Did Breath of Fire 3, did it not even get a digital release?
No.
In the U.S.? That's insane.
Not to my awareness.
That was a physical game over here as well. Mm-hmm. So that must be one of the more expensive PSP games for Americans to import.
Yeah, probably. There were a bunch of PS1 games that were ported to PSP in various like remakes or compilations, and very few of those made it to the US. Like the Gradius collection did, which technically had Gradius Gaiden on it, which was a PS1 game, but one, that game was never released in the US on PS1, so it wasn't just a port of an existing PS1 game in the US, and two, it had all those arcade games on it, so I guess that they managed to slip it through that way. But and then you had Symphony of the Night as a bonus unlockable in Dracula X Chronicles, but that was a bonus in addition to the actual like fully remade 3D recreation of Rondo of Blood. So so that Sony was really, really strict about PS1 games on PSP in the US, which is just infuriating because like then they let you play PS1 classics on PSP later. So come on, guys.
Yeah, but even then, some of them were really weird, and you could only put them on the PSP if you downloaded them to a PS3 first and then transferred them over.
Yep. Right.
Really bizarre. Really bizarre.
And so many more in Japan than we ever got here.
Oh, God. When I first made my Japanese PSN account, it was only maybe 8 months ago or so. I thought, yeah, might as well have a look. And then I went on there and I think there were maybe just under or just over 200 PS1 and PS2 games on the US and Europe ones. And there are 700 and something PS1 games on the Japanese PSN. And a lot of them are just in English. But they didn't release them over here for whatever reason. So I basically rinsed that, spent all my money, and lost everything. But it was worth it because, now I've got The Adventures of Little Ralph on my PS3.
Yes!
There you go. It's not a great game, but it looks nice.
Counterpoint, it is a great game, and it looks nice.
Interesting. Interesting.
That's why they call me the king of debates.
Can't argue with that logic. All right. So a lot of the stuff that is on this list, the PSN 100, you can still buy it physically, which means you cannot play it on a PSP Go. So PSP Go owners, you are SOL in just a few months.
Yeah. One title that I wanted to call out, I didn't actually play a whole lot on the PSP, but Patchwork Heroes is one that's a digital exclusive outside of Japan. So there's only a retail version over there. Mm. And it's a really wild spin, like a story-based spin on the Kix arcade gameplay of like sawing, cutting little edges out around an enemy, except you're doing it on the side of giant flying airships. And it was just a really cool little game.
Yeah, I shouted that one out on my list because it's probably the best Kix.
Okay.
Yeah, it's probably the best Kix clone that I've played outside of, unless we're going into the territory of those ones that have bare ladies in.
You better not go that way.
No, not till later. Another podcast.
That's Retronauts later. After Dark. All right. So with PSP, what is notable about these games is that I believe you can basically play all of them if you own them digitally on Vita. So you get a nicer screen, and I guess in theory, like a more durable format for them. And of course, if you have a PSTV, then you can play them through PSTV on a television and I've see them, you know, kind of blown up.
I've heard the PSTV is quite fussy about what it lets you play. Is that wrong?
Yeah, there's a smaller and smaller number from like PSP that's playable on Vita that's also playable on PSTV or Vita TV.
I don't really understand the PSTV. I didn't pay attention to it. And I don't really
Sony
know
didn't
it
understand it either, so you're in good company. the thing about PSTV is that it has a whitelist, and it's pretty trivial to defeat that whitelist from what I understand. I've never tried it myself, but I am under the impression that you don't have to work too hard to do it.
I tried at one point, and it didn't work, but maybe there's a newer method.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately you're just going to have to wait until Sony says, okay, we're done with Vita. We're never going to update you know, the firmware to do anti-piracy lockout measures. And then at that point, you know, it'll be trivial for people to just crack it open and not have to worry about their hacks being defeated. Because at some point, you know, the platform holder does just say, it's not worth fighting against the pirates and against the hackers. So whatever, it's yours, guys.
Yep.
All right. So, yeah, I do want to call out Brandish the Dark Revenant, because that was a very good remake of a Super NES remake of a PC 98 game that I think in its original incarnation was very misunderstood. But once you bring it into 3D, it becomes much more comprehensible. And the PSP version is really good. I found it very engrossing. And that was only available digitally in the US. There is a very saucy cover yes, in the Japanese version, some very titillating, literally cover art that Stuart pointed out when I recommended the game. But in the US, it's just digital, so it's very chaste. And then the PSP's big brother, I don't know, younger cousin. How the hell does this work? The Vita.
Ugly stepchild.
Yes, the Vita. The benighted stepchild. That's the one.
the console that everyone is always going on about how great it is. And every time they do it, I just look at them until they stop.
Well, Vita did have a lot more on digital exclusive games. So, you know, when that is delisted, it will be a bigger loss because, you know, Sony had really embraced digital publishing at that point. I mean, PSP had quite a few, but I think the most notable PS1 digital releases tended to be things like PlayStation Minis and PS1 Classics.
Yeah.
So, you know, with Vita, you did have more games.
Lots more indie games.
Downloadably.
It was sort of the indie games darling in a way, because it had all games like Loft Rousers and La Milana and stuff like that. Lots and lots of good indies on the Vita, which are now pretty much all ported to the Switch, but not Loft Rousers for some reason. They have not ported that.
Yeah, I think Switch basically came along and everyone was like, oh, this is like all the cool stuff we love about Vita, except the you know, the manufacturer actually likes this platform and is going to support it. So, yes, everything very quickly made its way over to Switch, just about everything. I would say most of the notable Vita digital releases, unless they are from Sony Studios, they are, you know, available to play on other platforms. So you're not totally missing out. I mean, there's stuff like Metal Gear Solid HD Collection, which was released physically on Vita, but you know, that's not on Switch, but for the most part, you know, this stuff has been made available elsewhere. So that's good.
There's a port of the Wii game Muramasa Rebirth, Vanillaware sort of ninja game. And there are three DLCs for that game on the Vita that weren't on the Wii version. There are just new mini games, basically. Where you play as new characters, I believe, and they totally change up the gameplay. And once that goes down, that stuff's gone. Unless it gets re-released on the Switch or something, that stuff's not coming back. So that's your only chance you're going to get to play that, is to buy it on the Vita.
Yeah. Yeah, now that Vanillaware is done with 13th Sentinel or 13 Sentinels, whatever it's called, maybe they're going to spend some time porting stuff over to Switch. That would seem like a likely business move to me.
I would hope so.
But yeah, when Limited Run Games first launched, a big part of the company's business was just bringing Vita games to cartridges because there were so many really great indie games that were released digitally only. And, you know, those, because that was part of the old Limited Run model where they were like, we're only selling 1,000 of these or 1,500. Yeah. Yeah. Those tend to be a little pricey now on the aftermarket. Just because they were produced in pretty small quantities, but they do exist out there, some of them. So, you know, that's good. And I think there were some other publishers. East Asia Soft might be one. A few others that released games for Vita in physical format. The Vita like manufacturing process in the US is shut down. So that's the end of that business here. But in Asia, there Sony is still supporting it. So there are still Vita physical releases coming from overseas, so you know, it's not a total loss yet.
There are a handful of Europe only Vita releases as well. I know that much. Nothing super special, but I know because someone asked me if I would buy them for them as a collector. But even the relatively mainstream Vita physical games are expensive now. That system seems to be a bit of a collector's dream in a way.
Yeah.
I know that the Danganronpa series, the entire Danganronpa series, has been delisted from the Vita now, I think. And they're going up and up in price. I mean, you can buy those on the PC, but they're going up and up in price now. It's the only place to get them handheld so far.
Yeah. Yeah, Danganronpa 2, another episode, V3, Trigger Happy Havoc.
V3 is one of the most expensive physical cartridges now over here as well. I don't know why, because you can just buy it on other stuff, but... Yeah, I guess not.
You know, I think with platforms that have a fairly limited library, like Vita, physical library, people want to do the complete sets. So, you know, this is something I found with stuff like Virtual Boy and Neo Geo Pocket Color. Like,
yeah, Neo Geo Pocket.
These are platforms where you look at it and you say, I could actually own all of these. I could have the full set. And a lot of people think that. And so it drives the price up on the really rare titles. And then people realize, oh, I can't actually have the full set. so it's a little heartbreaking.
There was a time in the past, maybe 15 years ago, where if you wanted a full European Neo Geo Pocket Color set, you could feasibly get it. The most expensive game was Pocket Reverse C, and that was at the time still only about £100.
Yep.
Now it's more.
Yeah, my boss Josh Fairhurst has a nearly complete Neo Geo Pocket Color set, which is one of the reasons Limited Run really wanted to publish the Neo Geo Pocket collection, because it's just, you know, like a personal favorite for a lot of people at the company. He now has a complete set worldwide except Pocket Reverse. It's the only one he doesn't have.
Wow.
He's like, yeah, sometimes I see it for $500 and I just don't know if I can do it. But I think at some point he's going to have to, just because it'll bug him not to have the 99% full set, not get that last game.
It's really funny to me that the most desirable Neo Geo game is Reverse-y, of all things. Yeah. Like, that's crazy.
It's not even, they couldn't even call it Othello. They didn't even put a license on it. It's just Reverse. It's just generic.
They lost the Shakespeare license. I don't know. Let me say, I want to just add, what a crazy world we live in where you can buy SNK versus Capcom Match of the Millennium on your Switch right now.
And it's like $6.
It's insane. Yeah. In fact, that leads us on to the PlayStation Classic stuff, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, actually, we're kind of running low on time, so because I've got another podcast I need to record soon. I actually think we could do just an episode on PlayStation Classics.
Oh, for sure.
I think that would be good. I think we should just talk about our favorite PS1 games for a while.
Well, I think that...
Those are some of my favorite
episodes. I think you could honestly do a whole episode just about all the cool stuff on the Japanese PlayStation Store that is not available here. And I don't think people realize just what a bounty it is. Like,
it's really remarkable.
The amount of amazing... It's stuff like... I don't know how to pronounce this. Einhander, is on there.
Einhander
is on there. Like Gunners.
Yes, I asked my former boss at IGN, Per Schneider, who is a polyglot and his native language is German. And I said, Einhander? He was like, Einhander.
Ah.
And I said, okay.
And now we know.
So that's the word from the official source.
It just blows my mind every time I go on there, and it's like these games that are or were ridiculously pricey, like Rakugaki Showtime, that treasure game that had about mm-hmm. 5 copies of it made, and that's on there for like 200 yen or something. You can buy the Sunset Memorial series volume that has Gimmick on it. It's the only way to buy Gimmick, unless you're buying that bespoke console that only exists for Gimmick, the Gimmick remake that's coming out.
Wait, what is that? A bespoke console for Gimmick?
They're making a bespoke arcade platform for a remake of Gimmick. I'm not making this up. I don't know the exact details of it, but it's the only way to get this remake of the game Gimmick.
Wow.
Mr. Gimmick. It's insane.
I have not heard about this.
You must look into this. See, Retronauts, everyone's learning. Everyone's always learning. That's what makes it such a great podcast.
That's what I started it for. Gimmick Exact Mix. Is that the one?
Yeah, Exa Arcadia Remake. Exact Mix. Yeah, only for arcades and only for a particular arcade thing, wow. I believe. Like, of all of the ways to make this game available again.
What in the actual hell? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
So just get it on PS1 with a Japanese account is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I mean it's not the best emulation, but it's that or get the ROM. Like that's the only options, or pay £1 million for the NES version from Scandinavia or wherever it came out. I just think it's crazy how much stuff there is that you can just go on there and buy that people don't seem to know you can do it. It's not even that hard to make a Japanese account, like that game LSD Dream Emulator.
All right, so let's do an episode on that sometime, soonish.
Yes.
I guess it would need to be soon too, since PSP is going away. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we've kind of covered the big bases. I guess we didn't talk about PS3. There are some cool things on there, but a lot of them, you know, again, aren't digital only, or a lot of them aren't exclusive to the platform.
Well,
a lot of them have been remade.
Yeah. One minor thing worth mentioning very briefly is the version on PS3 of Castlevania Harmony of Despair, which is the multiplayer Castlevania game. It's the only one with local multiplayer, so
yeah,
that's worth
buying. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's really weird that they didn't patch that into the other versions, but it really is the only one that has it. I think it's also the only place to buy House of the Dead 4 as well. That's digital only.
I was not aware of the local multiplayer. I only played it on 360, so that's...
Yeah, it's bizarre. You can just play it at the equivalent of split screen, you know? I mean, you have to kind of stay together. It's not ideal, but it's there.
All right, so... Anyway, this has been kind of a journey through the world of delisted games, games that will soon be delisted, and the general ennui and despair caused by delistings. Why do good games have to die? And the answer is because companies like money, and old games don't necessarily make enough money for them. Mm-hmm. It's very sad. So, yeah, thanks, guys. Any final thoughts, you know, to fire off before we... call it an episode?
Oh gosh, buy everything and download it as soon as you can. Just keep everything downloaded.
You're doing the industry's work for it.
Yeah.
Okay, quick one final thought, just to put the cat amongst the pigeons a bit, sort of throw in a bit of a hot take. Why not delist every game ever right now? There we go. Think about that.
Wow.
So you're doing like the no more mutants thing, but with video games?
Yeah, why not? Sorry then. You know, WandaVision's popular. People will get that.
All right.
How can you follow that? That's the real question.
I mean, it would certainly do wonders for limited runs business, but I don't think we necessarily need to go that route.
And mine, I'll never stop writing.
It's true. It's your life's cause.
And it benefits me in absolutely no way.
All right. That's kind of the real like, hey, why not do this? Just doing the devil's advocate thing. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not destroy many people's happiness for no benefit to me? the true devilry. All right. Anyway, Sean and Stuart, thank you both for joining in this episode. Thanks everyone for listening. And if you are listening, you should definitely grab the essential PSP games. Check out retronauts.com. Look for PS. What is it? PSN 100? Is that what you called it?
PSN 100. Yeah, all that's right.
Stuart's put together four different listicles, if you will. And yeah, the PSP stuff, I think, is the most vital. That's going to be the PSP article and also the PS1 classics. So check those out. Make a shopping list. Buy the things that you would not be able to play otherwise and savor them. Because even though Sony may not believe in that platform anymore, it's still good and viable and fun if you like video games, which you obviously do because you're listening to Retronauts, a podcast about video games.
Unless you've made a terrible mistake.
Yes. But if you have not made a terrible mistake, or if you have made a terrible mistake and are like, hey, I kind of think this is interesting anyway, you can find more episodes of Retronauts at retronauts.com and on your favorite pod catchers. Or whatever we're calling them these days. If you would like to hear even more Retronauts, you can subscribe to us on Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts, where you will be able to, I think for $3 a month, get every episode a week in advance of its public release with no advertisements, no cross promotions, higher bitrate quality and sound quality. It's a good deal. And for another $2 a month, $5 total, you also get bonus episodes on alternating Fridays. So that's two extra episodes per month, three on those weird months where there's like five Fridays. And also you get additional weekend columns by Diamond Fight, which come with little mini podcasts. So there's a lot of stuff that is only available through Patreon. That's my pitch. There's been lots of salesmanship going on this episode. I'm done. I'm throwing it over to you, Sean.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on. You can find more about more delisted games at delistedgames.com. And I've got all the social accounts and just started a Twitch channel that's going well. There's always more coming to the site all the time. So take a look over there. Thank you very much.
And Stuart.
Hello. Yes, you can find more writing by me on Retronauts. Hopefully, now that the PSN 100 is over, relatively normal service will resume, which means look out for some more Gex-based articles in the very near future.
And they're not even about Gex. They're just like Gex's perspectives on The Sims.
Yeah, that's my
Gex
new
Gex is basically, that's Stuart in a fursuit. Or
It's a scale suit. Come on now. I'm a scaly, not a furry. Come on. but also if you want to find out more exciting projects that I do, you can follow me on Twitter at Stupacabra. I do two podcasts. One is Arsalvania, which is about me and Andy Hamilton coming up with terrible, awful, appalling takes that will upset people and then tweeting them about video games, I hasten to add. And also Animania Chat, which me and Luke Fletcher produce, which is reviewing every single episode of the hit cartoon Animaniacs, which I hate more than anything in the world.
All right. And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite, on YouTube as Jeremy Parrish, doing stuff with limited run games. If you bought stuff like, hey, the Scott Pilgrim limited release, the CE version of that, there's a book that I put together. I wrote a little bit for it, but helping to do my part to preserve and enshrine video games. The upcoming Neo Geo Pocket Color collection has a big ass book from me. So you can check those out. And I think that's about it. So I guess we now march off into the arena to die at the pleasure of Jim Ryan. We'll be right back.